This episode is brought to you by Forever Cheese, a passion for great taste. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
Welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection of food and grief with me, your host, Zara Tangora.
And Bobby Conforto, your mom.
Bobby Conforto, who's giggling because I was just being very silly before we were recording this intro. Today on the show, we have an amazing guest, Iris Ruth Pastor, who joins us to talk about her 45-year-long struggle with bulimia. And I loved chatting with Iris. It was such a lovely conversation. It was great.
Really was. She really shared so much experience of having had this really difficult journey. And I think she did it succinctly and well. And I think the listeners will really understand more about what this really devastating addiction is like for.
Yeah. So, Bobby, Passover is coming up next weekend, and we mentioned in the end of this episode about a meal we want to share, and I was like, do you eat matzo balls for Passover? I just want to mention I am in the middle of ending one migraine and potentially beginning another, so I forgot that you eat matzo balls for Passover, but I know that you do, and I love matzo balls. And we're not very religious people, or I should say we're not religious at all, but we did grow up with, Jewish heritage and we love Jewish foods. And so yes. I just wanted to say I'm really looking forward to Passover foods that I'm going to make.
And making
myself
a matzo ball lasagna?
Yes, we're doing a collaboration with Shelsky's. It's a matzo ball lasagna. It's just dry matzo balls between layers of dry pasta. So get ready, people. It's going
to
be amazing.
Well, it would be fun to have an ethnic meal together. I consider it that it's more cultural and ethnic. Both of us have a view of spirituality, but not of religion. But I know I grew up with deep roots because my mom actually had an Orthodox background. So I have deep roots into the cultural and ethnic aspects of food.
Mm. Yeah, I really love some of the traditional Jewish foods and definitely traditional Passover foods. We talked about brisket earlier, sweet and sour brisket. Love stuffed cabbage. Love matzo ball soup. Kugel. Passover is about unleavened
things. Yes, correct. Yep. And I remember Grandma eating, loved matzah. Grandma loved, almost like burnt matzah with butter on it is one of the best things in the whole world.
So I can eat it with butter. I'm going to have some right now. I can't
Ooh,
wait.
Oh, good. Oh, I'm coming to Brooklyn to get some. All right,
you know
sweetie.
What's really good? Matzah with tuna fish on it. Now let's talk about
is a
all
crisp
our weirdest
cracker.
Snacks that we like.
And of course, there's matzah brei, which I remember growing up having that for breakfast, where you mix it with eggs, almost like French toast.
Yeah,
but you make matzah. Very delicious.
Love it. And cinnamon sugar on top. Okay. Well, guys, I really hope that you enjoy. If you celebrate Passover, or if you're just in it for the delicious food, or if you're in it for the religious aspects, I hope that everyone has a lovely Passover, because it will be going on as this episode airs, and that you enjoy our episode with the lovely, sweet, wonderful, I just got such a great vibe from Iris. She had such a wonderful energy to her. It was really, really
nice. And beautiful
nice.
Smile. I wish you could all see her
smile. She's just a wonderful human. It was really nice to connect with her.
Yes.
So, thank you so much, Iris, and we can't wait to come up to New York and we can hang out as we talked about in the episode. That's how we feel about all our guests. We love them all so much. And have a great week, you guys, and take care of yourselves and each other.
Bye.
So we are here today with our guest, Iris Ruth Pastor. Iris, hello. Where are you joining us from?
Sunny Tampa, Florida.
Oh my gosh. As we were kind of chatting about before the show, it's mildly sunny today here in New York, but definitely not warm. And we are very jealous of you.
But we can record in the summer when it's unbearably hot. So
that is true.
We are enjoying the March gorgeous weather. What can I say?
Oh, good. So, Iris, what have you been cooking lately? I mean, we're about a year into pandemic at this point, and I feel like some people are getting fatigued with cooking. Some people are still really into it. What have you been making? What's been going on in your kitchen lately?
When the pandemic first started, I went on a soup making binge and made all different kinds of soup, vegetable soup, pea soup. I made hamburger and potato soup and froze them all.
Ooh.
That was the good part. Then when I went away, my freezer went out. So all, all the soups that I had frozen thawed and then refroze, which made them unedible. So that was very disappointing. So my newest thing now is smoothies. And I have this smoothie recipe that I made up that I think is delicious and everybody else thinks is disgusting. But
okay, what is it?
Tell us. Yeah.
Okay, so what it is it's a half a cup of cottage cheese. It's a scoop of protein powder. I put in a couple of shakes of ground cinnamon and a mostly thawed banana that has been frozen. And I put it in my NutriBullet. And honestly, it tastes like ice cream. And everybody I tell it to goes, that's the grossest thing I've ever heard.
Oh, no, we've definitely heard grosser things. I mean, I think that sounds nourishing.
It sounds delicious, but you have to like it. That's the important thing.
I love it. I have it every morning. And I do sometimes do a variation, like using raspberries or blackberries or strawberries. But for some reason, the banana is the most wonderful thing to me. So I just stick with that.
Yeah, a banana is one of those kind of really perfunctory but like very useful fruits, right? You know, maybe it's nobody's favorite fruit because of you don't crave it, but it's, I mean, maybe some people, but it, you know, it's not like a peach or a pineapple or something, but it is, it really gets the job done
when you need it. Sure, it's fully ripe. That I found is very important. You can't, at least for me, I like them almost when they're rotten because then the taste is so much richer. So I think that's a consideration also.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Bobby, you know all about the soup craze. Bobby is a soup-aholic. Soup-aholic. Yes.
It's a great way to eat food.
It is.
Yeah. Having had intestinal issues most of my adult life, I find that soup is just an easy way to take in a lot of nutrients. And I make sure that I put every type of nutrient in it. And then it's an easy form of digestion. So I like soups.
The house smells so good. The house smells so
good. That is true.
That's true.
Soup. My grandmother was an Eastern European Jewish woman that lived in the Bronx. And she made soup all the time when I was growing up. And then I was fortunate enough to marry a man whose mother also made homemade soups. And my kids call that real food. And it is real food. There's something so down home and wonderful about cooking from scratch a big pot of soup.
Totally. So Iris, you mentioned your grandma. So did you learn to cook from grandma? I know that like your relationship with your grandma, as you mentioned before we recorded this episode when we were chatting, you talked about how your grandmother was a pretty big influence in your life. Was she influential in helping you kind of establish a relationship with food?
Yes, but probably not. It turned out not in the healthiest way. She died when I was 7, but up until the time that she passed away, I would watch her make vegetable soup and grind the meat with the meat grinder to make meat blintzes and that type of thing. And I always equated food with love until about the time I reached puberty. And that's when food became my enemy because it was helping me develop and put on weight that I didn't want. So I went from having a very strong, nurturing concept of food to food's my enemy. And that was a sea change for me.
Yeah. I mean, you know, was there something else that you can identify kind of during that time aside from puberty? Was there something else that was going on? Do you think that was reinforcing that feeling of, you know, having food be the enemy or?
Oh, absolutely. It was spelled B-O-Y-S, boys. And my hormones were raging at that point. I developed very early. And what I realized was that if I continued to stay slim, which is kind of difficult anyway, when you're going through changes in your body during that period, I would get a lot of attention from boys. And if I wasn't slim and trim, they no longer looked at me. And this was the late 50s, early 60s, when girls didn't have the range of choices they have now. It was pretty well focused on boy and girl relationships. And I see with my grandchildren, who are teenagers now, young teenagers, they're not really focused on the opposite sex the way that we were during those times. Mm. So that was why I think food became something that I feared, because eating too much of it was going to turn off the boys and make me feel very ordinary. And the last thing I wanted to do was feel ordinary.
Right. And I also think, like, when we think back to that time, is that I think if we take that a step further, aside from just, like, you know, wanting male attention, I think, like, there was the idea during that time, as, you know, a cisgendered straight woman, that you were meant to marry and that would be security, because there weren't as many, you know what I mean, options for women or any other kind of people other than straight white men to have kind of financial stability and career stability. And, you know, you had to kind of attach yourself to the male gaze to feel like you had stability. Is there a truth to that?
Is there truth to that? A lot of truth to that. Yes. Yeah. And I think sometimes it's very difficult for young women now to identify with how strongly we bought into that. But we really did. Mm. It was, who are you going to marry? When are you going to get married? My mother actually got married at 17, had me at 20. Mm.
Wow.
You know, that was my role model. And it,
right.
So my looks, I mean, that's what I was relying on. And to develop my mind and my talent and resources simply wasn't on my radar screen the way it was later in life.
Yeah, I'm sure it can be like a pretty, I mean, we've talked to, you know, several people on this show who have struggled with eating disorders as young people. And, you know, I know it can be kind of an alienating experience, because, you know, you're young and you're a teen and you're supposed to be in some way having fun. And this is like a carefree time in your life. And what a big care to carry, a big burden and, you know, just pain to carry, having to constantly think about weight and eating. And did you feel that?
You know, I felt that, but this, the idea that my eating disorder persisted for 45 years, the shame and the humiliation and the feeling inauthentic was so strong in me. I think it actually grew stronger as I got older, because I kept saying, what's wrong with me? What is wrong with me? I'm a grown woman. I'm not a teenager anymore. I'm not a sophomore in college. And the reasons that I had started binging and purging were pretty classic for an eating disorder like bulimia. And that was, I was away from home for the first time. My boyfriend had just broken up with me. I'd like to say I broke up with him, but he broke up with me. I had no idea what my major was going to be. I wasn't really in tune with my values and my strengths. I was very unformed. And I also didn't know anybody at this new university. I was a transfer student. So that was my way of taking control and being able to eat all these wonderful comfort foods, eat like a pig, but not gain weight and still be able to attract a boyfriend. So that, that was the way I felt then. But as I matured, I think the shame and humiliation was even worse, because I'm a grown woman. I mean, this is ridiculous. So
what I hear is that it started from lacking of self-acceptance, and that the more you did it, the more you didn't accept yourself, because there was so much shame and humiliation involved.
And also, I lacked self-esteem. I mean, it's hard to feel good about yourself, even though outwardly I got married. I ended up getting divorced. I remarried. I had a very solid marriage. I gave birth to 5 kids. I appeared to be coping beautifully. I had the perfect life, which made it even worse, because I had this shameful secret. And so it just, there was so much separation between the reality of what was going on in the inside of me and how I was appearing outwardly. And that caused a lot of misery.
That's a very good way of putting it. You know, I think it was the Buddha that said that happiness is when what we feel inside matches what we are outside. And what you're saying is there was discordant. It wasn't the same. You know, the world, you appeared to be happy and content, and inside you felt so tortured. That must have been so hard. And for 45 years, that's a long time to have that. What do you think some of the losses were that you experienced because you had an eating disorder for 45 years?
I think it was mainly the inner turmoil of it, because I was doing motivational speaking. I had been writing a column for all those years, and I would talk about everything, and I would be very personal in my column, but I wouldn't talk about that. So I think that it didn't really hold me back. It didn't really hold me back, but I think it caused a lot of inner angst that had I hadn't had it, I would have been more peaceful.
Mm. I think we also don't talk often enough about the grief of having a secret.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Because having a secret is, again, alienating. And it's one of those kind of things that makes us feel like, I don't know if there's a worse feeling than feeling like nobody understands me or nobody can relate. I don't, it's feeling alone, right? Like feeling that's scary and it's weird. And I think having a secret that nobody knows is one of the most alienating, like I'm all alone in this world kind of feelings. And, you know, I know anytime that I've had a secret, I've had that burden. And even just going through times where you feel maybe alienated from friends and family, like I know it's such a scary feeling and such a weird feeling. And I can't imagine the grief of carrying a secret like that for 45 years.
I think that took its toll. The feeling of no one understands this. I'm in this alone. When I've talked to other people that have expose their eating disorders, that especially bulimia, because bulimia you can't tell. Anorexia, you can usually tell when somebody's anorexic. But somebody said to me after I published my book, they said, well, like, send me a picture of when you were bulimic. It was like, hello, I'm the same. That was the point. You couldn't tell. But so there was one burden of feeling alone and isolated. And many people with bulimia had that feeling. And so when you let your secret out, you think you're going to be relieved, but actually it causes a lot of pain and a lot of, like, people aren't real anxious to hear about that. And they don't know exactly what to say and how to react to it. And then you have the family who didn't know about it and you're blasting it all over. So it's not a done deal when you come out with your secret. You have to be prepared to meet with indifference and resistance and defensiveness, a lot of things. Mm. It's not just an instant relief. You have to come to terms with a lot of things when you divulge your secret.
Mm. Now, when you came out with your secret, did you then begin a process of trying to heal the eating disorder?
No. What I did, Bobby, was actually the opposite. I never told anybody till I was well on the way to recovery. So I decided it was in 2012, Valentine's Day. I was the last time I binged and purged. And I said, I just can't keep doing this to my body. And then I entered a treatment center. It was right before I turned, it was right before I turned 65. And the reason I did it then is because the eating disorder treatment center did not take Medicare. And I knew I'd be going on Medicare. So I went to this eating disorder treatment center. I did a 3-month outpatient program, but I had stopped binging right before that, but didn't know if I could sustain it. That's when this the healing process began. I didn't actually start telling people maybe till a year or two afterwards. Mm. I couldn't do it while I was still in the throes of the bulimia. It just didn't feel comfortable to me. I had to feel that I was past it, at least. Not that I was going to go back to it every day before I started coming out and revealing what my history had been.
Yeah. Iris, can you tell us a little bit more about the healing process? You know, I know from experience that often eating disorders, you give them a name called Ed, you know, which just means that you have a relationship with Ed.
Oh, yes.
So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I can. My book talks about Ed as a male figure. not erectile dysfunction, eating disorder. And I also actually have a musical that I'm working on now with Ed as a character. And I wrote a serious play before that about Ed as a character. So you're absolutely right. Ed is a force to be reckoned with. And I think in my case, it definitely, what scared me the most about Ed and what showed me how powerful he was is that my first husband, who I met in college when I was binging and purging, knew that I was binging and purging. This was the 60s. He and I had no name for it. No one had a name for it. He just thought it was quirky. And he asked me one day to stop. I had eaten a great big meal. I had steak and potatoes and onion rings and pecan pie and a Coke. And then I just proceeded to go in the bathroom and lock the door, and I was going to throw up. And he says to me, "You've got to stop doing this. If you don't stop, I'm leaving." Okay. And do you know what I said? See ya. Goodbye. And that moment I chose Ed. And that was such a defining minute for me, because I realized the power that Ed had over me. And my marriage did break up. It didn't break up because of Ed, but that stayed with me. And when I got married to my second husband, and we've been married almost 45 years, I was so terrified that I couldn't share this with him, because if he asked me to do it, I knew I wouldn't be able to give Ed up, and I didn't want him to become part of my battle. So I kept him completely out of it.
Yes. You know, they say it, with any addiction, that your main relationship is with the substance. So what you're saying is that was your marriage. That was your primary relationship with Ed.
And Bobby.
So tell us more about your healing.
I actually want to just jump in very quickly and say something, which is that, you know, you initially said that you started kind of binging and purging as a means to attract like male attention. And then, you know, you got married, you had the, you know, quote, male attention that maybe had been idealized as a young woman of finding a husband or whatever that, you know, ideal was to you at the time. And then once you had the thing in which you had, you know, been binging and purging and had this eating disorder for in the first place, it wasn't actually the problem. Do you know what I mean? I just find that interesting, that the thing that you had been doing it for actually wasn't even wasn't as important as the disease, as Ed anymore.
Well, Ed became a vehicle for so much more than just attracting a male. And basically what I realized over the years is it was a way to cope. It was a way to relieve anxiety and depression and stress. It was a way to manage my emotions and control my anger. So I didn't have to face a lot of different things. I could be a pretty good coper because I was binging and purging every night and getting all that stuff out of my system. So you're right. It evolved from attracting a male to really a coping mechanism for managing my emotions. And it stayed that way. And you bring up a very good point, because it served a function. That's why that habit or addiction or behavior, whatever you want to call it, continued, because it provided me something that I needed. And until I was able to find other substitutions for that, I couldn't give it up. And this is another thing I want to tell both of you. I've listened to a lot of people, a lot of women in midlife and beyond who had bulimia, either early on throughout their life or intermittently. And one of the things that they said is that they had been in therapy but never discussed it. And that's very common. And it was exactly with me too. So I would go into therapy and talk about depression and stress and anger and all these things and learn from it. But I still continued to binge and purge. And I think one of the reasons when I decided to stop purging that I was able to is that I had already absorbed so many good things from therapy that I was able to eradicate Ed because he no longer had that power over me. But I didn't really realize that fully. It took me a while to realize that the reasons I had binged and purged for so long no longer existed. And that,
right, and you built the better resources in the meantime.
Absolutely, yeah. Bobby, absolutely.
So tell us about some of those resources. What are some of the resources that have helped you deal with your emotions, manage yourself?
Well, writing was always an outlet for me. And so when I wrote my book, which is The Secret Life of the Weight Obsessed of a Weight Obsessed Woman, that was very cathartic for me. But then I also started doing things and taking pleasure in things that I, because Ed was my pleasure, so I didn't have to have any ancillary pleasures. Stupid things I started, like taking a long hot shower. I enjoyed that. Walking, you know, just rocking in a rocking chair. Going back to knitting, which, you know, I always like to say knitting keeps me from unraveling, but it's a very soothing and creative type of a hobby.
Right.
So I started finding enjoyment in other areas, and it finally got back to doing some cooking. But for years, my cooking was very perfunctory because food was something I was fearful of. And I was afraid to, like, if I baked a cake, I eat the whole batter and just throw it up. So, it was a gradual process back to not only cooking, but talking about food, looking for recipes, being experimental in what I wanted to eat. That only came years after I had overcome and ousted it.
Yeah. And it's such a deep routine to break, right? Like, we talk about trying to break habits and addictions and routines, and the grooves in our brain are dug so deeply in things like that, and in addictions.
Because it's
like
fear-based, because it's so fear-based. You know, what I gathered from some of the things I read about what you wrote was that there was you feared food, like you said before, because if you would start to eat it, you'd be afraid you wouldn't be able to stop.
Yes.
Is that true? Yeah.
Yes. And I'll tell you the other thing that really helped me. When I stopped binging and purging, I realized there were so many things I didn't know how to handle. One of them was portion control. I had no idea of portion control, because if you set a cake in front of me, and I would just eat the whole thing, because then I'd go throw it up. So how did I know what was going to make me satisfied? So what I did, and a lot of times people in the eating community professionally don't like to hear this, but I went to Weight Watchers. And I, first of all, when I came out of treatment, I was heavier than I wanted to be. And I knew I wanted to take the weight off, but I also knew I had to understand when I was hungry and what filled me up. And I had no basis for that ever. So Weight Watchers taught me portion control, and it also helped me identify when I was hungry. I didn't even know when I was hungry, because it didn't matter when I was hungry. I ate whether I was hungry or not. So those were all kind of little victories along the way that helped me get back to a more normalized pattern of eating. So I learned when I was hungry, how much it would take for me to get full, because I don't have that automatic thing in my head where you put a plate in front of me and I'll eat until I'm stuffed, or I'll eat until I'm comfortably full. No. I would just eat the whole thing, because I doesn't.
Yeah.
So it was learned behavior. The other thing that I embraced, but not easily in the beginning, was this whole intuitive eating theory, which is if you let your body kind of go naturally, it will tell you what it needs. The most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard of at first. Because my body's telling me I want to eat 8 Oreos, so I'm just going to go ahead and eat it. So that was a very, very difficult concept for me to understand. And I still struggle with that.
You know what I'm hearing throughout this, Iris, is that if through your growing up, you didn't have a relationship with yourself, and that you have come to have a relationship with the self.
Yeah.
That it was hard to be with yourself.
Yeah.
It was hard to know what yourself needed. It was hard to know what yourself was healthy or unhealthy. So is that true, that with these, the hobbies you described are singular hobbies, time with yourself, being comfortable with yourself?
Yes, I think you totally hit it on the nose. And I had no sense of self. And the interesting thing is, because I wrote a column and I did speeches and different things like that, other people had a sense of me, but I didn't have a sense of myself, which was really disconcerting. But Bobby, that really, I didn't have that. And of course, the other part of that equation is, once you get a sense of self, you want to treat that sense of self as compassionately as you treat your friends, with kindness and passion and empathy, that's the other thing I consciously became aware of, is like, if my friend were going through this, what would I say to her? And that was an eye opener. That was truly an epiphany, to treat myself as nicely as I treated my friends and family.
That's very powerful. That's the truth. Yeah.
Well, you know, so something that I always kind of think is, that I always have a question about when I think or hear stories about people who have struggled with eating disorders, is so many of us turn to food as a kind of comfort, right? You know, when we associate it with warm feelings of holidays and celebration and all this stuff. So when food is so complicated, your relationship with food is so complicated and often so painful, what did you turn to other than food in these times of, like, you know, to get joy, to get comfort? Where was your self-care and your kind of enjoyment of life coming from?
Well, this is kind of interesting. One of the things I did when I was in the 3-month treatment program, and it was outpatient, is after the evening session, I would come home. And at night, that was the scariest part for me, because that's when I always binged and purged. So a couple of things I did. I changed where I watched television and where I sat. I went into an upstairs loft out of the kitchen family room area. But I turned my binging into binge watching, and I became obsessed. And during that time, I had never watched Grey's Anatomy, and I watched like 7 seasons of Grey's Anatomy. But to this day, I tend to be a binge watcher, where if I'm going to watch something, I'll watch it in the evening for 3 hours. So I really replaced it with something that was probably as habitual.
But right. Healthier, but much healthier.
Much healthier, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the knitting. The knitting is, you can't eat and knit at the same time. So I definitely
kept your hands busy.
Yeah, I keep my hands busy, and I do purses and afghans and different things like that don't take real intricate kinds of stitches, so I can do it while I'm watching. But those things were very important to me. And what I also found is I had spent, and we kind of alluded to this earlier, I had spent so much time berating myself for being out of control, that when I was in control and I had this excess energy, I put it towards creating. I put it towards just like the whole world is a sponge to me, and I'm constantly learning and doing and out there and exploring new things, because I felt like I had such an inner struggle for so many years. And I've heard other people say the same thing, is that the time you take thinking and agonizing over what's wrong with me, why am I out of control, why am I eating like a pig, why can't I overcome this, when you do, it's so liberating.
Of course it is. There's hours and hours and hours of negative thinking about yourself, right?
Yeah.
And so now you're freed up.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, like, life is scary when we think about it. Even people who have a relatively uncomplicated life, and then the more complications that come into it, and trauma and family issues and all kinds of stuff, like, it gets scary to think how little control we have. And I think that most all of us try to find certain ways to feel like we have control. And some people are workaholics, and some people are alcoholics, and some people are nervous, and some people are bulimic. And I think that it's important to remember that, like, life just is scary and we don't have control. And so it's very normal to want to try to push up against that. And, you know, when we try to find ways to push up against it as young people, that's not always the right way. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, right. when you're 16 years old and you're trying to find a way to get control of life, and that's such a time when you're, you know, coming into your own, it's such a transitional time. It's, you know, I think forgiveness to yourself and understanding that it's so it's so reasonable to like allow something like this to, you know what I mean, to fall into something like this. Like it's unfortunate, and I feel so much for you and anyone else who's gone through an eating disorder or any other kind of addiction. But I think there's also an element of it when you can come to the other side to have compassion for yourself, because it is so hard to find ways to cope with just being a person, you know.
Compassion instead of self-loathing.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That was a very big step for me. But the other thing, the sea change I went through, is that I began to realize I was doing things for healthy reasons. In other words, it used to be focused so much more on my looks, like, oh, I'm going to diet and lose weight so I look good in my bathing suit or whatever. And as I matured and watched friends become ill with things that they couldn't control, I became much more focused on doing things for the health benefits rather than how I looked. And I think part of that also was, as I grew and matured, I realized, especially I think being Jewish played into this, about how Judaism says that your body is a sacred vessel. And here I was abusing that. And that caused a tremendous amount of guilt in me. So the other side of it was, when I stopped doing this, I felt renewed and much more spiritual. And that gave me kind of a serenity that I hadn't had before, that, you know, I'm doing good things for my body. And also the fact that I have grandchildren, and is this the legacy I want to leave for them, mm-hmm. that their grandmother died in a pool of vomit? And seriously, that was stopped. It was like all these things I've done that have been good and creative and resourceful, and then this is what they're going to remember me for. That's not compassion.
You could have compassion for them, for your children and for your grandchildren, but you learn to have compassion for yourself. You know, you mentioned the word serenity before. There's a reason why the serenity prayer is used in 12-step programs. You know, it is such a powerful thing, you know, telling us to notice the things, really notice the difference between the things we can control and the things we can't. Because if we keep focusing on the things we can't control, we don't notice all the things that are right in front of us that we can control.
That's
and generally, those are the internal things. We can't control others. We can't control what happens to us in life. But we can control, hopefully, our response to what happens to us in life.
But the downside was I wasn't controlling it. So yes, that was even right. adding.
To- yes, it didn't even work anyway. Well, that's the problem with addictions. They cause more problems.
Yeah,
we think that they're, like you said before, you thought it was trying to solve a problem.
Yes.
And like Zara pointed out, it was, as a young person, it was what you could think of. It was creative in a way when you were young.
It was very.
But then it stopped working, and the habit of it was so hard. It got into your brain chemistry, and it was just hard to change. You know,
yeah.
But how inspirational that you did change after all those years, because that's a long time to have an addiction.
I
ask another personal question? What impact did having bulimia for 45 years have on your body?
You know, it was interesting that you asked that, Bobby, because I had it down to a science. I would binge on things like ice cream, which came up very easily. Mm. And I would eat health. I mean, I binged and purged through every pregnancy. But I took my vitamins and I ate healthy. And it was only at night at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock that I mostly would eat, you know, half a gallon or whatever of ice cream and then just go throw it up. So I really did have minimal impact from that. It did impact my teeth.
Mm-hmm.
It impacted my teeth. And I think it changed my voice. My voice is scratchy. But when I decided I had to stop, when I was purging, my stomach muscles were starting to contract, and that scared me. That scared the hell out of me. Other than that, I really didn't suffer any ill effects. But I only did it at specific times, and I ate healthy basically ate healthy the rest of the time. Crazy.
Yeah, you had five kids. My goodness, you have five children.
Yeah, that's amazing. So but I mean, I'm not saying, oh, you know, you can binge and purge and you won't have any health issues. That's just not true. But
right.
I was conscious of those kinds of things, and I was conscious of eating very healthy. And if you eat ice cream and throw it up 5 minutes later, you know, chances are that what you ate for dinner is going to still stay down. So
wow.
Interesting. Iris, we ask everybody the same question who joins us on Processing as we near the end of our chat together. But if you could have given yourself one piece of advice kind of at the beginning of this experience for you, knowing what you know now, having gone through it, what would that be?
I think be your own best friend. That's what I think is most important. Be your own best friend. Because if you can't be there for yourself, you can't be there for your family, your friends, your community, you just can't. And that's what I learned. And women sometimes have a hard time with that. But I think I told you this, Sara, that my whole template is preserving your bloom, which is kind of a payoff on my name, Iris. And what it means is using your talents and resources to be the best you can be, which is really self-care. So that's it. Be your own best friend and good things will happen.
That's nice, wonderful. Iris. We have one more way that we close our processing, and that's what coming to the processing table. If we were all right now to prepare a meal together and we could sit down and enjoy it. And I think we should think about Eastern European foods because Zara and I also have that background. So if we could all make one of our favorite dishes that we wanted to share with each other, what would it be?
Bobby, do you want to start?
Sure. I mean, I guess I would have to say what I said before last week. I love chicken soup. I love to make it. I love the sweetness of it. One of my secrets is I put a little bit of sugar in it when I make it, a little bit of honey or sugar. And I also put sweet potatoes in it. I put a sweet potato cut up as one of the vegetables. And it has just this sweetness and it's so warm. And I would make some matzo balls because I was watching a Bobby Flay showdown last night and they were making matzo balls. So I would make matzo ball soup.
Passover is coming up. Oh, yes. No, you don't do Passover matzo balls, do you?
Yeah, you do, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, of course. So what would you make, Iris?
I would say I would make brisket. There's something about meat. I know, you know, it's not completely politically correct in these days, but they're calling to me like the smell of a brisket and the taste of it. And such comfort food. I would say brisket.
And how do you make brisket? How do you make your brisket?
There's one. My grandmother didn't use this recipe, but someone else had given it to me. And you use a first cut kosher brisket. But you make a sweet and sour and you use Coke. And I'm not sure what the rest of the ingredients are, but one of them is actually regular Coke.
And I love that. That's fun. I think that's really fun. I like to put in my brisket ginger snaps.
Ooh.
Ginger snaps.
And I like to put apricots in burgundy and ginger snaps. Yeah.
Oh, wait, I have one other thing that I've just discovered a couple years ago because my friend's son is a chef. Majol dates with blue cheese, with crumbled blue cheese.
Yum. Oh, that sounds delicious.
Yeah. That will be our dessert. And Zara, what are you going to make for this feast?
Well, I was going to bring dessert. I like that matzo crack, the stuff you put the matzo, when you put the caramel, like... it's kind of like toffee and then chocolate and sea salt. And it's like makes it like a little candy with matzo in the middle. It's delicious.
Oh,
crackly
somebody
matzo.
Made that for me once. Okay. Well, delicious. We have a great processing table.
Yes. Amazing. Iris, it was so nice to connect with you. You have such a warmth and you exude a natural warmth. You have this amazingly beautiful just aura around you and attitude and vibe. So it was just so wonderful to be in your company for this past 45 minutes. And we've been chatting for a while and we're so happy to have finally gotten you on the show. It was really, really just so lovely. What a lovely Friday morning conversation to have with you.
Thank you. I so appreciate it. And I just want you to know, I do get to Brooklyn in New York. So.
Oh, well, please.
I'll get together with you at some point.
That would be so fun.
Oh, we'd love that.
Oh my
we
gosh,
would love
that would be
it.
Wonderful. Then we could have this meal for real.
Yeah,
we can spend some time. Thank you for sharing your story. And really, like, you know, it is so important to talk about just, you know, whether it's an eating disorder, any other kind of addiction or anything. It's just what we were talking about before, I think is really so central to the importance of sharing these kinds of stories is that it feels so lonely for people and they can feel like, oh gosh, like, why am I doing this? Or I'm strange for doing this, or I'll never be able to stop. And we all only get this one bit of time on this planet. You know what I mean? And if we can kind of aid each other in being able to not feel so lonely in these times and with these issues, I think it's really important, you know. And I think the grief that people can actually feel from struggling with an eating disorder is very real, and it's very painful. So thank you so much for being vulnerable and open and sharing about that. I know it's going to help a lot of people.
And guys, remember that Iris wrote a book, and the book is called The Secret Life of a Weight-Obsessed Woman. Correct? And you also have some other, you have a podcast, and you have, can you tell us about that?
Yes, I put out a newsletter every Friday at 3:00, I like to say before Shabbat, and you can go to my website and sign up, which is irisruthpastor.com. And yes, I do podcasts, and my book is available anywhere books are bought and sold. So that is definitely something.
Awesome. Great. Iris, you're amazing. Thank you so much. It was so great to meet you and connect with you, and we can't wait to see you again soon. Thank you, and enjoy the wonderful warm weather in Tampa.
Thank you so much.
This episode is brought to you by Forever Cheese. Forever Cheese has been a pioneer in the specialty food industry for over 20 years. They source the most exceptional, authentic, and creative artisan cheese and accompaniments from Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Croatia. Every product they carry is thoughtfully hand-selected from their trusted producers in Europe. The standards of Forever Cheese are legendary. Many of their products, including Drunken Goat, Genuine Fulvi Pecorino Romano, Mitica Marcona Almonds, and Fig and Date Cakes, are now integral to today's market. You can learn more about their product lineup at forevercheese.com. Forever Cheese is proud of their role as a trusted authority in the specialty cheese world. Their philosophy is to put passion behind everything they do, from finding the best products to celebrating those who make them. Forever Cheese, a passion for great taste. Thanks to Forever Cheese for supporting this episode. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
Thank you so much for joining us for Processing. We realize that sharing these types of deeply intimate stories on air is a very personal decision. We began this project as a way to connect our listeners through shared experiences and storytelling. We hope that Processing can be a platform for sharing, learning, and healing. We appreciate our guests' willingness to be vulnerable and value nothing more than making both our guests' and listeners' experiences with our show positive and progressive. If you're interested in being a guest on the show or writing in a listener letter, please email processing@heritageradionetwork.org. Please follow us at processing_podcast on Instagram. Processing is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.